Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about politics and demographics in America today and how those two things are coming together. And here's some numbers for you to think about just as we start out here. In 1976, less than a quarter of the American people lived in counties that are sometimes called landslide counties. And what that means is these are counties where the spread between the two major presidential candidates was 20 percentage points or more. By 2004, almost half of Americans lived in landslide counties. And the question is, well, why? What happened there? There are some variety of ways that you could explain that. But our guest this morning for this hour of the show, Bill Bishop, says the one that seems to make the most sense is that to the extent that people have the means to do it, more and more people are choosing to live with other people who generally think the way they do. And that this kind of sorting happens not just on the maxi level where we're talking about states and we talk about red states and blue states. He says this kind of thing can happen by city, even neighborhood by neighborhood. That's the argument that Bill Bishop makes and we will talk about in his book, The Big Sort. The subtitle is Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. Bill Bishop was a special projects reporter at the Austin American Statesman when he started out thinking about this and writing about this. He did some stories for the paper in collaboration with a sociologist named Robert Cushing, who taught at UT Austin. And they started people thinking about it. And this is, in a sense, an expansion of those articles that he wrote for the paper. He's also worked as a columnist for the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader and as a reporter for the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, anybody who's listening can call in, share their thoughts with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, or across the country on the Internet, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you got a question, you can give us a call. Mr. Bishop, hello.
Hey.
Thanks for talking with us.
Happy to be here.
We appreciate it. I want to come back to this, as I'm sure that it's where everybody starts, talking about this change in landslide counties. But before that, I guess as a more general kind of question, I'd ask you to maybe talk a little bit about how it is you started thinking about this and writing about it.
Okay.
So go ahead. Was that not an open enough invitation?
Yes. That is such a good the tone of your voice changed, and okay, I'm ready. I'm here. We started on this not as a political group of stories, but as an economic group of stories. We were interested, Bob and I, in why Austin and a group of cities were doing so well economically in the 1990s and 1980s, and cities in like Boise, Idaho, and Portland, Oregon, and San Francisco, and Austin, and Atlanta, and Chicago, and what we found was that they were doing so well because people with talent were moving to those places. We could see that in 1970, people with BA degrees were relatively evenly distributed around the country, city to city, but over the next 30 years, they began to sort themselves into particular places, and they congregated, they clustered in cities, and also Austin slurped up people with BA degrees. And Cleveland and my old hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, didn't do as well. And so because they didn't collect this type of person, their economy suffered. And as we looked, we could see that this sort of sorting took place just across the board. I mean, young people went some places and not others, and white people left entire city regions and moved to others. Blacks moved to some cities and not. And during this process, Bob, the statistician, thought, I wonder if this has any political consequences. And what he found was that in 1980, this group of tech cities voted that we were looking at, about 21 tech cities, including Chicago, were voting at about the national average Democrat-Republican. But over the next 20 years, they became increasingly Democratic. And meanwhile, low-tech cities and rural areas were becoming increasingly conservative and Republican. And so we began to see that not only were we sorting economically, we were sorting culturally and politically. And at that point, we began to look at counties. So we really came at this from an economic point of view, not from a political point of view.
And I suppose that, you know, for those people who would say, well, this is not exactly a new trend, I suppose you would say something like, well, no, it's not exactly a new trend, but what has happened is that we've seen an acceleration to the point where maybe now we've, there's been some kind of, to use the popular recent phrase, there's been a tipping point here. It's reached critical mass. Somehow it's gotten to the point where it has a much greater impact than perhaps it would have had a decade ago or 20 years ago.
Well, the tendency for people to birds of a feather to flock, right, mm-hmm. has always been part of human nature. It's a question of finding safety among people who are like you. And so the question becomes, why was this trend increasing? If people have always had the tendency to get closer to people who were like themselves, then why did we see a 50% increase in the percentage of landslide counties between 76 and 2004? And really, in close elections, it was almost like a stair step as that percentage increased. And then as we began to look further, we could see that this sorting took place really across the board. Churches tipped either conservative or liberal. Clubs, the clubs that we belonged to no longer were sort of general but became more ideological. Markets were no longer, mass markets disappeared and target markets appeared. And so in every aspect of life, we could see that we were sorting into smaller communities of a more like-minded nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, that invites the question, as you say, the question is why? Why have we gone beyond what the kind of tendency that we saw before of people essentially to hang out with people like them to a more extreme or more dramatic kind of sorting, the kind that you're just talking about? So why?
Well, I think the old society kind of slipped away. Our old divisions that we still continually talk about in terms of class and work and the standard demographic demarcations of politics, those began to lose salience in the way we lived. I mean, you know, you talk to people, they don't say, I'm a white male, age 55, with a BA degree. That's not how they describe themselves. They describe themselves as, you know, I'm an environmentalist, or a woman from San Diego described herself as a ocean-oriented person. And in fact, when you talk to marketing people, talk to the marketing guy who did work for Nike and is now doing it for Apple, and he said Steve Jobs at Apple told him, don't use any demographic information because that's not how people live their lives. And so increasingly over the last 30 years, people have defined themselves through lifestyle choices. And what we've seen is that parties have aligned not with particularly with issues as much with ways of life and how we've come to see ourselves and how we've come to express ourselves in the way we live.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I guess that there were some people who would then wonder whether this kind of plotting out and grouping people that has been used and developed by marketers as a way of identifying their target consumers has gone beyond just their attempt to sell things to people, that has then actually had an impact on how people define themselves. That is, it's not just the marketers identifying particular segments. People seem to understand at some level that they are, in fact, that they do belong to those sorts of segments. They think about themselves in those terms. And so something that was a construction that was developed for the purposes of selling things has actually changed the way people think of themselves and the way that they define themselves in a way that they're actually conscious of.
Well, I think it is a sort of a self-reinforcing cycle, but I think the marketers actually began with who we are and how we were defining ourselves, and it makes it easier, right? And it can be really simple. The makers of power bars began selling to marathoners and triathletes because that's who they were. And then when they needed to break into other groupings, they didn't have any connection. So they had to hire people who were tennis players or kayakers or hikers, or they had to actually think about that group as an entirely separate people that they needed to attach themselves to. And I think you're right that becomes a self-reinforcing deal, and it's certainly true in our politics. And what it does in terms of politics is it increases polarization, because like-minded groups, as they cluster together, become more extreme in the way that they're like-minded. There was an experiment in France that is pretty classic. They had French students who didn't like the United States were asked to get together and talk about the United States. And at the end of an hour or two conversation, they tested the students, and they disliked the United States more than before they began their discussion. So as these like-minded groups politically and socially and in terms of lifestyle cluster, they become more extreme in their political thinking. I mean, it's certainly true in my neighborhood. I live in a very Democratic neighborhood, and it's not enough to say that George Bush was wrong. He should be impeached. There should be criminal investigations. You can't say enough bad about the guy in order to stand out in our very Democratic group. And, of course, the same thing's happening on the Republican in Republican communities.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Bill Bishop. He is the author of The Big Sort. The subtitle of his book is Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. He was a special projects reporter at the Austin American Statesman when he started doing research on this particular subject, and wrote some articles for the paper in collaboration with Robert Cushing, who's a retired professor of sociology who taught at the University of Texas at Austin. His statistical studies form the basis for the book, The Big Sort. And if you'd like to look at the book, head out to the bookstore or library. It's just recently published by Houghton Mifflin. And questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment to go back to this change in the landslide counties, it is really dramatic when you take a look at that. And if, for example, it's made even more dramatic if you can see this. We can't show this on the radio, but if you see this on a map, the way that you have laid out the maps here at the beginning of the book of politics before the sort and after the sort, looking at these counties where there was a dramatic, where they went dramatically either one way or another, either went overwhelmingly Republican, overwhelmingly Democrat, polarization has really changed the face of America politically, and certainly in terms of people's political identification, and then also in terms of who we see in the White House and who we see in Congress.
And it extends. You can go to thebigsort.com and see those maps, and you can sort of see where your county is placed in that change. But it happens at sort of every level. States have become, I think in 1976, the average margin between Carter and Ford at the state level was about 8%. By 2004, the average difference by state between Kerry and Bush was over 14%. Congressional districts tip either increasingly Republican or increasingly Democratic. So our representatives represent us, which means they represent a people who an increasing larger and larger majority within those districts. So it has all these consequences in Congress of people representing districts that are so strongly either Republican or Democratic that they really have no reason to compromise. They're not pressured from their constituencies to to listen to the other side. And so we see this kind of gridlock in Congress that stems directly from the way we've sorted ourselves.
Do you really think that's the case in if we think about a time where people were, in terms of, say, their political identification, were more mixed, and maybe you, just for purposes of argument, you'd say, let's pick two people and we'll have a conservative Republican living next door to a liberal Democrat, which sounds like a sitcom. But do you really think that...
Can we get Paris Hilton?
Yeah, as a special guest appearance during ratings period, of course, we'll do that. You would wonder whether, to what extent these kinds of people in the past would have spent time talking with one another, arguing about politics, and whether, in fact, that would do anything for each of them to think, well, gosh, maybe I might want to change my mind, or maybe my neighbor who is has this different political orientation, well, maybe he has a point, whether that kind of interaction would do anything to make people more flexible in their attitudes. I mean, or is that just sort of a thing that, like, we wish that would be the case, and it may not actually work that way in practice?
Well, I think a couple, I mean, it may be that you might think that your neighbor was an idiot, but not evil. I mean, these days we think of those people as often criminal. But I think a couple of things have happened. One is, ages ago, you were more likely to be in a club or in a situation with someone who disagreed with you politically. The second thing is, we weren't as divided on so many issues. I mean, there might have been there were differences between Republicans and Democrats on a couple of issues, but where we are now is that for example, I had a Republican county commissioner in Central Oregon tell me that the anti-abortion people in his district no longer ask him about abortion; they ask him about property rights, and they know, because they know that his answer on property rights will accurately reflect his position on abortion. And we've gotten into this state where, instead of some issues bubbling up and being a point of contention between the parties, every issue that bubbles up fits neatly within some Republican or Democratic confines. And so your position on immigration predicts what you think about health care, which predicts what you think about the Iraq War, which predicts what you think about how we should deal with Iran and with abortion rights and gay rights and stem cell research. And it becomes such a problem, because there's little overlap between the parties on nearly every issue.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it does go back to the point you made about the fact that if we have this hypothetical, neighborhood or district where it's that mixed, and if I represent that district at whatever governmental level we're talking about, and if it is mixed, then somehow I have to take into consideration the interests of a diverse population. And somehow, if I want to continue to get reelected and represent those people, somehow take into account everybody's interests. That may lead me down one kind of political road. But if my district is solidly conservative Republican or solidly liberal Democrat, then it's a whole different kind of deal. And you can take a more kind of a hard line and toe that line. And then what happens is, when you get to the point where you have to negotiate with your fellow representatives, whether this is, in the state house, in the Congress, or whatever, then maybe you have less kind of incentive or less inclination to make compromise, because you're going to hold so tightly to whatever the litmus test points are.
Right, and you don't want to, if you're in a strongly majority area, you don't want to be mistaken. If you're in a strong Republican area, you don't want to be mistaken for something less than the strongest Republican. So the tendency in these groups is to be slightly more Republican than the group, or slightly more Democratic, so you won't be mistaken for something, for a traitor. And so, I mean, this has been a part of human nature. Saul writes in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, about how he was rewarded for being the person who persecuted Christians the most harshly. And so, and Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's said it pays to be top banana in the shock department. And so that's what we have is in talk radio and in politics. It helps to be top banana in the shock department. No one mistakes you for a traitor or someone on the other side, and that whole process just makes all groups more extreme over time.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them in moments. This is our line four, toll free line. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David. Very interesting program. I joined the conversation a little bit late, so let me apologize ahead of time if you guys already covered this. But just a couple of quick questions for your guests, and I'll ring off and listen. Observation, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and way back then, about 1,000 years ago, it was really a city of neighborhoods, of middle class. And it seems to me that the middle class, I think much along the same lines as New York, been squeezed out. Those who could get out to the suburbs have gotten out, and it's not more like a community anymore. I mean, you have the extreme wealthy, and then you have the extreme poor, and it just seems an inevitable split there. But my question is, I was wondering, with your studies, did you make like comparisons with income and also with race? In other words, does it seem to you like extreme wealthy people kind of get together, and with regards to race, more along the lines of segregation by choice? And can't we look at those and make political assessments of, how these people would vote based upon that information? And I'll go ahead and listen off there. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I think what the caller is saying is this general phenomenon. Keith Poole and some other political scientists have written a good book about the decline of the middle class and how that has affected politics. I'm looking for the name of it. And they say exactly what the caller said, is that the polarization between parties has been exacerbated by the economic polarization in the country. Now, we looked at the racial aspect, and we did the same measurements that we used to determine whether there were increasing number of landslide counties. We did that with race, and you could see that between 1980 and 2000, whereas the political segregation increased by about 50%, racial segregation, though still extreme, declined a little bit. So the ideological segregation that we see was not driven by racial segregation. And it seems to me that it's hard to tell with income how that drives it one way or another. I mean, I live in a rich neighborhood, and we're all Democratic, and ditto with San Francisco. And so I don't know. I think it's driven not by race or by class or by income, but more by way of life.
All right. Well, I thank Carl. Let's go on to someone else here. We have a local caller in Urbana, here where we are, and it's line one. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. How are you?
Yeah.
Interesting subject. I think that when I listen to you speak, it seems to me that this still stays in the rhetorical level, and that you have people like you have the right-wing talk host, the left-wing, whatever, and, maybe stirring the pot with, anti-Bush or pro-Bush, that kind of rhetoric. And so we don't really have the we delineate. I mean, I know a lot of people in a lot of different what you call groups, classes, and stuff. And I don't really, don't talk about politics and religion, and you're pretty much all right. But I think the commonality in America is sort of commercialism. And you can delineate by living in a, like you said, you live in a wealthy neighborhood. So, down the road, there's a couple of lower middle class, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't have the tribalism you have in, like, the third world or lesser developed countries, I guess is a politically correct statement. We seem to more have a a level of tolerance, even though you might have an extreme viewpoint, like you may support Bush and Iraq and the war on terror and all that, but you still probably have more people are more tolerant than I think a lot of people want to give them credit for. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think that that's maybe what we have in common nationally, is that we have this incredible diversity place to place, mm-hmm. and what we may have in common is simply our tolerance for groups to be as different as they want to be. But I can tell you that within those groups, within those neighborhoods, that tip one way or another, and that's the majority of the neighborhoods, there is often extreme intolerance for those with different views. I mean, a county commissioner here in Austin had lived in a Democratic neighborhood. He was a Republican. He finally had to move. His car was being vandalized. We had the Democratic Party chairman in a county about 50 miles west of here told me that a couple of July 4ths ago they built a float, and but when it got time to run the float down Main Street, they couldn't get anybody to ride in the float. No one wanted to be identified as a Democrat in a highly Republican county, and larger studies have found the same thing. Political minorities in places with heavy political majorities, mm-hmm. they don't vote, they don't speak out, they're reluctant to even join in community activities. And so people pay a price for being different within these neighborhoods.
But would you say that's really a commonality in almost, I mean, in the United States, it's probably, historically you can look at that and sort of say like they have this Civil War based on the people that wanted to own slaves or whatever that, or states' rights is a better word, versus the more like the nation, a nation of like-minded people. That's sort of a commonality. I would agree that there are people that probably don't speak, but so would that person move to a Democratic area that's feel more comfortable? I mean, I still think, how do we teach tolerance? I mean, I know it's a describable term, and it is an emotional experience, and you can be, fever pitched by someone, or you can have an ideology very easily. But I see an occasional where, like years ago, they had the kid in Wyoming that was killed, the gay kid that was killed, high school kid, and that sort of intolerance is, inversely in the media would talk about it as a huge negative, like, why are you doing this to an individual? Leave me alone, leave them alone. Do you think that's how is that doable? I mean, your book states the problem. Is there a solution? Thank you.
And that's a great question, because it is high. Americans are the most. Diana Mutz wrote a book called "Hearing the Other Side," and she tells us in this book that in a study of 12 industrialized countries, Americans were the most eager to talk about politics, almost as eager as the Israelis. But they were the least likely in the 12 nations to talk with people who had different opinions, and the least likely among in America to have a discussion partner with a different opinion were people who had been to graduate school. People with only a high school degree were more likely to have discussions with those who disagree. And I think the caller is absolutely right that we've kind of lost the ability to hold two different opinions or two different thoughts in our mind at the same time. And part of that, I think, is that we feel about politics more strongly than we did before. There, Mutz makes the argument that perhaps we need to be a little more apathetic. Apathetic people are more likely to listen to the other side. People who feel strongly about their politics are less likely to listen. Democrats over the years have been less likely to listen to George Bush on his State of the Union address. And similarly, Republicans were increasingly less likely to listen to Bill Clinton when he gave his State of the Union address. We don't listen to the other side because having to confront what we believe with contrary opinions almost physically hurts.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Bill Bishop. He was a special projects reporter at the Austin American Statesman when he started to do research on this very subject here on city growth and political polarization. He wrote some articles for the paper in conjunction with Robert Cushing, who's a retired professor of sociology. He taught at UT Austin. And that work grew into a book that you can read now. The title of the book is The Big Sort: Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. That's the subtitle. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It's out now in bookstores. Bill Bishop's been a newspaper reporter for a while. In addition to working for the Austin paper, he was also a columnist with the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader and a reporter for the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky. And questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go on again to someone in Champaign. Next, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This might not be something that your guest has any data on, but I was just curious when you mentioned how, like, two neighbors of different political viewpoints living next to each other is like a sitcom. It made me think of myself because my significant other and I, while we're not married and we don't live in the same household, we have vastly polarized political views. And actually, we do have a friend who's a married couple, and they have, you know, different political views too, and it just made me wonder. I wonder if there's any data out there on households and households with mixed political views. And if I'm sure that number is very small, but I just wonder if it's something that's kept track of or something that's changed in recent years. It definitely keeps things interesting. I can tell you that. You never run out of something to talk about.
I don't have any. I do know that. I mean, social psychologists will tell you that opposites don't attract, and that people really do mate with those with whom they have a large areas of agreement. And in fact, Match.com and some of the internet dating sites use political compatibility as one of their ways of trying to match people up. So. You have a rare relationship, I guess, and although the fact that you are cohabitating is without before marriage is a definite democratic sign. So we begin to put you all in a category here right away.
Well, my partner and I aren't cohabitating yet, but we do have a friend who's a married couple where, you know, she's a Democrat, he's a Republican, but it works. So, and that might be my situation in the future. So,
well, good.
Anyways, thanks for your comment.
All right. Well, good luck with that. Yeah. Let's go on to another caller here. Back to Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I guess my comment would be about a recent anti-Bush, anti-war demonstration, a rather small one. And it occurred on top of one of the overpasses where a banner was displayed, carefully kept from being over the side, impeach, and not any statement about whom. I guess the variety is so great now. And a number of anti-war signs. And there seemed to be a very strong support from the people passing. Although there was one car that went by where there was a V sign displayed from one window and the driver had an obscene sign from the other window. Two cars threw objects at the demonstrators. And there apparently were several calls to the police that the demonstrators were obstructing traffic. They were not. The police came out, looked the situation over, and laughed. They did suggest that in the future we station one person with a camera in case there were more assaults on the demonstrators. But it was interesting to me that there were these two people that threw McDonald's soda in one case and ice cream in the other at the demonstrators, and then went through a red light. They were apparently so afraid they'd be caught.
That pretty- pretty much describes our political discourse now, doesn't it?
Yeah, somehow I can't imagine a liberal throwing anything, but anyway.
We had one neighbor in our very democratic neighborhood put up some Bush signs, and they didn't last 24 hours where they were ripped up in shreds and left on his front lawn. So, and the Republican county commissioner had his in the very democratic neighborhood in Austin had his car keyed and egged and his lights punched out, and they particularly rubbed the eggs over his Republican bumper stickers. So I think we're all capable of insanity.
I'm sorry to hear that happened. I've had requests when I took my signs down to put them back up after I finished mowing because people missed the anti-war signs. But anyway, for what it's worth.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Other questions, comments, stories are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. In having talked about this earlier with a colleague, going back to this this question of how it is that people go about deciding where they're going to live. One could imagine all sorts of things. For example, if you had children, you would think about the schools where you were going to live. Or maybe you would want to know, were there good parks? Maybe you would want to know, is this a safe place? If you were a big environmentalist, maybe you would say, I want to live in a place where there's good mass transit, and I can walk to shopping or ride my bike, it's some variety of things. But making some determination about and maybe that is the way that you actually make a determination about the politics of the place. I'm still interested in this idea about how it is that people size up a particular place or decide that they would want to live one place as opposed to another.
Oh, well, yeah, I think all the what you described are those have become political choices. I mean, there are all sorts of funny games. You have developed all sorts of games to be played in my neighborhood. I mean, if your neighbor's feng shui the local junior high school principal's office and do a smudging and rice blessing in the principal's office, you have an idea that perhaps you're moving into a democratic neighborhood, which is what happened in mine. Or if your neighbors have bowling ball art in their yard, you pretty much. But there. There are other ways. Republicans in Scott County, Minnesota, which is an exurb outside of Minneapolis, told me, "Hey, you know how you can tell a Republican neighborhood? You measure the distance between the houses, and that is essentially true. The greater the density of the neighborhood, the more Democratic the vote. Or you describe mass transit. Robert Lang at Virginia Tech noticed that he was mapping the vote." In the suburbs of Washington D.C., and he saw this little node punch out into the exurbs that became Democratic that 4 years before had been Republican, and he began to look at why that sort of pimple had punched out there and become Democratic, and he realized that a metro stop had gone in there, and Democrats like to ride. Things on rails and public transportation on rails, and so that subway stop, that metro stop, had attracted a Democratic constituency. So that's what I'm saying. Is all these our choices about ways of life have now aligned with politics, and so we do these things almost unconsciously.
Well, that's just in a sense that's sort of discouraging because it makes me think that for example, and maybe this tells you something about my political orientation. I guess I would think that something like mass transit ought to be nonpartisan, that the idea that you could by just simply asking someone a question about do you think it'd be a good idea if we had a better bus system or a better rail system or did something to give people alternatives to driving their personal transportation, if somehow that was a test. And by asking that question, you could tell whether somebody was a Republican or a Democrat. And it seems to me that to make the whole business of, for example, dealing with urban infrastructure having to do with transportation, it gets to be pretty complicated if it, just the idea of mass transit gets politicized to the point where you could tell whether somebody was Republican or Democrat based on whether they wanted to ride the bus. That seems to throw a whole new set of complicating factors into basic kinds of political, social, public policy issues.
But that's exactly the world we live in. So college graduates in Portland are more likely to live downtown and are more likely than high school graduates to ride public transportation. You go to Phoenix, more Republican. College graduates are less likely to live downtown and more likely to drive cars rather than go on public transportation. So you have the same demographic type of adult college graduates, male, female, white. Democrats live downtown and ride public transportation in Portland, and Republicans live in the suburbs and drive cars in Phoenix.
Well, what certainly seems to be the case is that we have become a very divided and fairly closely divided country, politically speaking, at least if you look at the last couple of elections. You can definitely start an argument about what happened in 2000, but I think that it's true to say that if you look at 2004, that despite the outcome, that was a close election. And now we're looking ahead to another one. Do you think that the kind of divisions that we have identified and you have looked at the book and seem to be in place here, do you think that for the foreseeable future, that's going to continue to be the political landscape?
Well, it extends, it's our way of life, and so it appears no matter what the race. So in the contest between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, we did our landslide county measurement, mm-hmm. and we found that half the people in the primaries, in the full primaries between Obama and Clinton, lived in landslide counties. And that, in fact, the split was almost, if you look at a map of Missouri from 2004 general election between Kerry and Bush and the 2008 primary election between Obama and Clinton, you can't tell the difference between them. You can't, if you just see the colors of who won which county, you can't tell the difference. Clinton won the Bush counties in Missouri, and Obama won the Kerry counties, and that was generally true across the country. Those two candidates had constituencies that were entirely different, lived in entirely different places, had entirely different ways of life, and it was a split, and it was the same split that we found in 2004 and in 2000. So the split really wasn't about ideology or about policy. It was really about how we live. That every time we get a chance to split, we split in the same way.
Yeah. Well, looking at that, then, if you look at the landslide counties and people, those counties where it seems that they're solidly going to go one way or another, that there's not a lot of toss up. Now, again, if you look at that map that we talked about, there are counties that are considered to be competitive, where there can actually be a toss-up. And interestingly enough, if I'm reading the map right, ours is one of them that could sort of, you know, go away one way or the other. But if you look at those that seem to be solidly in one, you could count them solidly one or the other. Does that tell you anything about who the next president of the United States might be?
Boy, it just tells me that it's going to be really close, and that both candidates have a challenge that is based on ways of life. Can Senator Obama reach out from the cities to those areas that Al Gore and John Kerry lost and Hillary Clinton won? Can he break out of that sort of liberal, democratic, urban archipelago that has marked the last... the last two elections? And then McCain has the opposite problem. Can he reach back into the cities and pick up those inner suburbs that Republicans have been losing for a while, and at the same time maintaining his Republican constituency in the exurbs and in rural America? It's they both have a real balancing act to perform.
Just to, again, to remind people what we're talking about when we use the term landslide county. Again, this is this idea that this is would be a county where, in a presidential election, the spread between the two major party candidates was 20 percentage points or more. So the thing we've been talking about here is the fact that in 1976, less than 25% of Americans lived in landslide counties. But by 2004, it was getting to be almost half. And then the question that we have been talking about that you explore in the book is, well, what happened there? And your argument is, the argument is backed up, is that it has a lot to do with self-selection. Now, I'm sure that there are people who also would look at that and say, well, gerrymandering must have something to do with this. The way that districts are drawn, because both parties, when they have the opportunity, they're going to try to draw districts that will either elect a Democrat or a Republican, and that that they would try to, in a deliberate way, engineer the kind of thing that we have been talking about. To what extent do you think that has been a factor, and that some that the parties have tried to take advantage of a demographic trend, and in fact have maybe intensified that by the way that they draw political lines?
Well, we looked at counties, and no one gerrymandered county lines, so we took all that out of the picture. Now, when political scientists looked at this question about why congressional districts become increasingly Republican or increasingly Democrat, which they have become over the last 20 or 30 years, they find that gerrymandering has very little to do with it, that most of the change takes place between the time that districts are redrawn, not at the time when districts are redrawn. And there's a big argument that you can get into the book and see about that, but the conclusion of all the studies, actually, is that, no, it's how people move. And it's the migration that is really changing our politics. So Colorado is becoming a purple state. Why? Well, because the largest contributor to the Colorado population outside of Colorado are people moving from Democratic L.A. County in California. And so people are moving from California and largely from blue counties outside of Colorado into Colorado around Denver and Boulder, and the state is gradually turning purple. But it's not because people there are changing their minds. It's because people are moving in. More people move in the United States from one county to another than are born. And that movement of people is changing the politics, especially in the West, in Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada.
Well, if one makes the argument that this that maybe this kind of sorting and clustering is not healthy for American politics, and you can certainly make that kind of argument. If you said you would like to do something to try to counter this, or to, at the very least, I guess, the idea would be to try to create some way so that people who had different political ideologies, who were different, at least had some opportunity to mix it up a little bit, to get to know one another, to exchange thoughts, ideas, and so forth. Is there, given that this trend that we've been talking about has been going on for a while and intensifying for a while, do you see anything coming along to turn this around or to modify it, even at the very least to modify it some?
Boy, it's, I think the biggest change is going to be generational. I talked to a bunch of kids and interviewed for the book about the emerging church, and I think the generational appeal of Obama is that the new generation of kids is not as interested in these stark differences. They're more comfortable with nuance, and they're able to hold these different kinds of opinions in their minds at the same time, and so you have these very biblically oriented churches growing up all around the country, but they aren't judgmental in the way that the mega churches were. They're not. I had a kid tell me from Minneapolis. They says, I grew up in a church where I was told thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that, and even though I believe in the Bible literally, I don't want to be in a church that does that. And so they're the Scum of the Earth Church in Denver and Bluer in Minneapolis and Sojourn in Louisville. There are all these churches of kids in Spider-Man T-shirts and that where the very Christian, very strict Christian-oriented, but comfortable with difference. And I think that's a generational change that is will perhaps sort of flush out this kind of polarization and help us become a society more comfortable with difference.
Hmm. And I wonder if people are actually have heard enough about the disintegration of these kinds of institutions within society that used to have some kind of role to hold people together and bring them together. You know, this is the whole idea of the bowling alone trend. Have heard enough of that so that there are people who are starting to say, you know, maybe having those kinds of affiliations was actually a good thing and that we ought to rebuild them, maybe not necessarily go back to the old ones, but find new ones that will have that same kind of function.
Yeah, there are... the marketers describe this as hiving now, and people are trying to find meaning within their community, but the community is a niche one and one that is increasingly like-minded. So I think there is an interest in finding those relationships. There is not an interest in finding those relationships across ideological boundaries.
Well, there's a lot of interesting things to be found here in the book, so I would certainly suggest that people take a look at it. The book that we've been talking about is titled The Big Sort, and the subtitle is Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin by our guest Bill Bishop, and also with the help from Robert Cushing. He's a retired professor of sociology who taught at UT Austin. His statistical work formed some of the basis of the book, and our guest Bill Bishop, he was a special projects reporter at the Austin American Statesman when he started writing on this subject. He's also been a columnist for the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader and as a reporter for the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Thanks very much, Mr. Bishop, for talking with us today.
Thank you, David.